Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the fifth in the Commonwealth Club's Social Entrepreneurship Series. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, Social Entrepreneur in Residence at the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mary Houghton. Pioneer and visionary are not words that can be used for everyone, but they are certainly applicable in Mary's case. Mary Houghton is one of the four co-founders of the Shore Bank Corporation and has had various management responsibilities over the years. Shore Bank has been at the cutting edge of social banking since its inception in 1973 until its new reincarnation as the Urban Partnership Bank. She has been especially involved in creating Shore Bank Pacific and Shore Bank Enterprise Cascadia, which are innovative programs that I hope she'll mention, if not, we'll ask questions about during the program. She has been an advisor to National Community Investment Fund, establishing ShoreCap International and ShoreCap Exchange. She is a director of the Calvert Foundation and Women's World Banking, a member of Ashoka's Global Academy, and a Schwab Foundation group of social entrepreneurs. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mary Houghton to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much, Ruth. So I have to tell you that there are three or four ex-Shore Bank employees in the audience, and they will catch up my lies. I thought I would talk on banking on values as opposed to banking on all the things that banks generally bank on, and talk really about banking as a growing form of social enterprise. You know, our general counsel at Shore Bank was fond of saying that if we ever woke up one morning and found that Shore Bank was not on the edge, we would move there immediately. Well, Shore Bank definitely found itself on the edge in 2010. Thankfully, all of the component parts of Shore Bank have survived, even if under different ownership, like the Urban Partnership Bank. But the corporate structure did not. So going forward, all of the 12 companies of Shore Bank are well-managed. They are social enterprises. And five are profitable businesses, seven are healthy not-for-profits, and independently, we expect that they are going to continue to try to change the world. I want to spend a little bit of time describing community development banking in the United States, and then a little bit of time describing social banking and microfinance internationally. A little bit about some of the failures that either Shore Bank has experienced or the world has experienced recently. And then I want to end by talking about two really difficult niche businesses that I really care about, but which are much tougher to do than and don't happen so often. And then, finally, I have a possible declaration of independence for social investors in social enterprises, which I'd like to urge you to think about. And before doing all of that, I want to get you to think about three terms of art. What is triple bottom line? What is inclusive finance? What is capital plus? So when people say triple bottom line, what do they really mean? When Triodos Bank in the Netherlands says so eloquently that lending can create value other than financial value, what do they mean? Well, it means very different things to different people. In Europe, it might mean organic agriculture. A bank in Bangladesh, it might mean they're going to branch into small business lending and they're going to start looking at cash flow and market analysis as opposed to just character. For Shore Bank, which aspired to change a market on the south side of Chicago, it meant finding what ended up being hundreds of African-American entrepreneurs who were able every 24 months or so to buy another building, fix it up, manage it, and ultimately change a market until this Great Recession did occur to us. So triple bottom line banking is different in different places, but the idea that you can create value, which is not merely financial value, I think is the key. I like the term inclusive finance, and increasingly we're using it. It's in the old days we used to call it access to capital, access to credit. But if you think about it, inclusive finance really plays on the idea that we live in societies where there are many, many people with entrepreneurial energy or investment energy, and if we figured a way to include them in the system, the society would be better off. Capital Plus is a simple notion. A bank loan is not the beginning and the end of success for anybody. Capital is, on some level, a commodity. And people who are going to succeed need access to knowledge, not just capital. So at SureBank, we manage this kind of difficult combination of 12 companies in order to be more than a bank, in order to be able to offer services or take actions that were well beyond what a regulated bank could do. It's not an easy strategy to implement. It does mean that you have the advantage of having a sustainable banking activity at your core, and then you can try over the very long term to implement other strategies which would be integrated with the bank and which would maybe get you closer to your goal, in our case generally of poverty alleviation. In the last few weeks, we are all reminded that we now live in a country that has 43.6 million people living in poverty, the largest number in the 50 years that statistics have been kept, up from just under 40 million last year. 26% of all African Americans live in poverty. That's more than a quarter. 25% of Hispanics and 9% of whites. Where I worked on the south side of Chicago, the official unemployment rate in the last year was over 20%. And generally in African American communities, the unofficial rate, when added, would cause you to double those figures. So these are very distressed communities all around the country these days. So we need this idea of social banking or more modern banking or value-added long-term banking now sorely. If at all today banks prioritize loans to their best customers, and best usually means substantial personal and business net worth, but if there's no flow of credit in a market, think of all the things that will happen if that market is not affluent. Homes can't change hands. Businesses can't finance growth. Investors can't do new things. Even Jonathan sitting back there can't do new things without financing. Consumer needs are not specifically addressed. So community development banks exist in order to be anchor investment companies in communities, using the power of the regulated banking system to leverage deposits and keep a flow of capital moving through the community. There was a SOCAP conference here this week, and I'm told that 1,300 people came. So there's growing enthusiasm for this idea of social capital investment, social banking, social enterprise. They described their meeting as the intersection of money and meaning. The four people who founded SureBank were almost as young as some of the SOCAP attendees when we started. We were all in our 30s. We were biracial. We had a very big idea. Why couldn't a community bank be a community development institution? At that point in time, bank credit was unavailable in our market. It was as unavailable in 1973 as it is completely unavailable today. and then racial discrimination and preference for affluent customers dominated all bankers and all credit decisions. So we bought a failing $40 million institution, and we ran it with loan losses no higher than our peers for 35 years. We were not as profitable as some banks, and it is the case that we used the bank's earnings over time to staff the launch of all these companies. So in the end, with hindsight, we probably would not have done that. We would have accumulated more capital at the bank level. But we created a very large number of minority entrepreneurs, often through this business of housing rehab. Each year, we're able to lend 3 to 4 times our average capital account in new loans on the street. And we created this incubator culture, which supported the growth of these 12 companies that will now continue to innovate independently. So I'm going to give you just a brief look at what's the landscape, you know, of how many of these banks are there in this country, how many credit unions, how many loan funds. Today, there are 81 commercial banks and thrifts that specialize in banking in low-income markets. Each of them has taken the trouble to get certified by the U.S. Treasury, and those 81 banks have $27 billion in assets. Then we did some research at the National Community Investment Fund, and we looked at all 8,000 banks, and we identified 500 banks that were the had the highest percentage of their loan portfolio in housing loans and the highest percentage of their branch offices in low-income markets. We would have preferred to have been able to look at small business lending as well as housing, but we were dealing with public data. So we found 500 banks that were the high performers. And that does tell you that there's not just 80 banks that could do this work, but there may be 500 who are already doing this work. And we're going to try to coin a new term and call them community development banking institutions. So in addition to these banks, 500 of them, there are 230 community development credit unions in the United States. They have total assets of $11 billion. And Ginger, where's Ginger, who runs the Santa Cruz Federal Santa Cruz Credit Union up until 8 days ago, is here and is a high-performing credit union. So if you all deposited your insured savings resources in these banks or thrifts or credit unions, you would add to their loanable funds. They really need to be supported now because the large banks have fled these markets. The large banks are hardly lending in affluent markets, much less poor markets. If we could figure out the kind of equity that would be useful to these banks, they could continue to grow. Today, all of those categories I just described to you totals up about $240 billion in assets. Does anyone want to guess what percentage that is of the total banking and credit union assets in the country? Guess go. Anyone? Yes.
4%.
Nope. Lower.
1%.
Nope. 1.7%. So we live in a society that has banking assets of $14 trillion. However, this pathetic little group of banks have the ability to advance about $40 billion a year in loans. That's just in case you wanted to try to think of what $40 billion is. That would be putting out $120 million of new loans every working day of the year, $120 million a day. So it's not peanuts. It's not $14 trillion, but it's more than a lot of efforts that you know about. In addition to these regulated institutions, there are another 600 loan funds. They call them CDFIs, Community Development Loan Funds. They account for another $5 or $6 billion. They do a lot of highly innovative work, and they don't keep everything on their balance sheet, so they're bigger than that $5 billion sounds like. And then there is now beginning to be a group of environmentally oriented banks. We were able to help start up the first one in 1997. Today there are, Vince, what do you say, 6 or 7 green banks around the country. 2 of them are here in this market, New Resource Bank, which Vince runs, and one California bank, which my colleague here just introduced me to himself. And one California bank has just bought Shore Bank Pacific in Portland, so it's going to expand up the coast. Now I'm going to flip. So that's the U.S. landscape. And we should care a great, great deal about the lack of bank credit in these markets. You know, economic activity stops if there's no flow of credit. The most exciting thing I know internationally is a very small but wonderful effort called the Global Alliance for Banking on Values. It was spearheaded by Triodos Bank in the Netherlands. Shore Bank and BRAC in Bangladesh co-sponsored it. And in the wake of the financial crisis, Peter Blum, who is the CEO, the founding CEO of Triodos, decided it was time to take a stand and just say, you know, there is a better form of banking than the one that we have all just experienced. It's long-term. It sees value creation as more than financial value. And so he has done the work to put together what is today a group of 10 banks. They have together $12 billion in assets and 1 million customers around the world on 4 continents. And they intend to keep growing, persuading banks to join this idea. And their goal is to get to 1 billion customers on every continent by 2020. They're serious. They're going to create an equity fund to invest capital in this group of banks. They've recruited a very big organization. I don't know if it's we'll have to expurgate the tape if this is confidential, but Vancity Credit Union in Vancouver, which is a $14 billion institution, has just joined them. In addition to those kinds of social banks, there is, of course, the microfinance movement internationally. Raise your hand if you've been watching microfinance, because who hasn't been watching microfinance, right? So, you know, it turned the world of foreign aid upside down. All of a sudden, we make investments, not grants, loans, not handouts. We have scale, not anecdotes. It's a very exciting field. There's a person sitting in the second row here, Julia Vendacious, who created one of the first microfinance organizations in the U.S. to try to replicate what was going on at Grameen Bank. It has been a wonder to watch. You can make small loans to very poor people for working capital. You can do it profitably, and you can do it at scale. There are today 200 microfinance organizations around the world. They each have more than 30,000 customers. There are lots of microfinance organizations that have, well, not lots, but maybe a dozen that have more than 1 million customers each. Some of them have 5 or 6 million. I was lucky to be in Bangladesh on the day after the Grameen Bank got its bank charter in 1983. And I was spurred on to learn how to use one of those newfangled things called a PC. And I learned how to use this software called VisiCalc. And we did the long-term financial projections for the Grameen Bank that year and for the next decade. So it was a great window on the beginning of microfinance. Since then, I've followed many talented, extraordinarily talented entrepreneurs who have been attached themselves to microfinance. I've had the chance to be on the board of Women's World Banking and Acción and now the Calvert Foundation. Julia and another colleague created 2 early U.S. adaptations. In general, microfinance has not done as well in this country, but Acción Texas is a fabulous U.S. operation. Maybe Wise here in San Francisco is doing well. There are only 25 million businesses in this country, 25 million, who have either 0 or up to 5 employees. So it's, you know, it's a huge category of the self-employed. It's very hard to serve here. But globally, microfinance is much bigger and more exciting, really, than what's going on in the United States. Visionary leadership, lots of money, the ability to manage an institution that can grow 30 to 40% a year, every year for 10 years. And some of them now are shifting. One of the reasons why they do well is they just do one thing. They make small loans. They haven't up until now even been trying to mobilize savings too much. But now some of them are expanding. So there's a German organization called ProCredit, which is now only doing small business loans. Sewa Bank in India is succeeding with insurance. BRAC Bank in Bangladesh is about to start a very big-time mobile banking activity, helped by our affiliate, SureBank International. So it's going to be a lot of fun to keep watching these organizations and to try to replicate this level of ambition and determination to actually affect what is happening in one society. Now a minute about the big banks. They are really large. There's actually representatives here from them, too, so I have to watch my words. I think that you should look to the large banks in this area mainly for mass market products for consumers, for product innovation, for wholesaling services. They're really too large to do some of the work that is needed when you're dealing with relatively uneducated borrowers. There's a lot of activity in this area, and with technology, the unit per unit costs of a lot of transactions have gone way, way down, so it may now be much more possible to deliver products that poor people actually need and can use. You can look and see what KeyBank has done, a whole suite of profitable services for low-income people. So the large banks, in part, are very serious also, and that's where the money is, and so we really need to collaborate. Let's see. Three lessons from the Great Recession, two of them about SureBank, okay? And then mainly the story about SureBank should be written by an independent business analyst about 3 or 4 years from now, so I'm not going to answer too many more questions about it. But like I said this first one, like the rest of the global banking industry, we should have kept higher capital levels. We were always well capitalized, but we were lulled by the profitability and the low loan losses that we experienced. We put our emphasis on could we get more money out on the street every year, and we probably should have many years ago raised enough capital so that we would have had longer to withstand the tumult that occurred in our market. We had a very specific strategy of targeting a local market. We were going to restore normal markets on the south side of Chicago. We had this fabulous niche, real estate rehabbing, which was profitable. It had huge impact. We should have tried harder to have a second and a third profitable niche. You know, we were not diversified enough away from real estate lending, so that's a great lesson for other people who follow SureBank. And then third, a thought about the regulators. When we were in the period of the real estate bubble, regulation was lax. Profit-seeking money poured into these new niches, often in highly inappropriate and unsustainable ways, like the predatory mortgage product. Nobody could compete with those players for equity or for share of market. We tried to go up against them in our market, and there was no way they could beat us in speed and product every day of the week. And then, you know, even though some people may have benefited from this huge opening up of credit, there were lots of people who did not benefit, ultimately lost out. And then when a bust comes, the regulators become very tough, right? So they're loose at the wrong time and they're tough at the wrong time. And again, capital is not available because the regulators want you to have more and more capital. Governments are stretched. Equity flows to the big guys who are too big to fail. So our regulatory system really did not help us out, either in the boom or the bust. Now, lastly, there's these two niches that I think are worth focusing on, but which are not as easy as microfinance or even community development banking. It's much, much easier to run a sustainable business that makes a loan than to run one that delivers a knowledge service. The borrower is really pleased to pay for capital. He's not at all pleased to pay for knowledge, because knowledge is a kind of a public good. I have a very good friend in India. His name is Harish Hande. He's the founder of Selco in India, which sells solar cooking and business products to poor women. He has found that he must provide highly customized products. The products that are good in one state of India are not good in another state. He's found that he has to provide post-acquisition maintenance, and he has to do a lot of relationship building in order to get these products developed. And so it's a great example of why a social enterprise might not be fully self-supporting, right? It's covering a lot of activity which nobody will pay for. So we need softer forms of capital. We need patience. We probably need for many of these activities to be based in a lending activity which is sustainable, or some activity which is sustainable. And then we have to come up against all the people who say, yes, social enterprise is fabulous. You can maximize both profit and social returns. You can have it all. And if you don't get it all, you know, it's not really very good. If you can't both make 18% return on equity and have a documented excellent social return, you haven't done anything. But who says that all investors want to maximize their return? Can't you choose? Can't you choose to take a return which is X minus 2% because you're happy if it's complemented by a specific social return? I, for my part, would much rather work to increase the pool of investor money that would sometimes accept a lower market return than to work to generate pools like a recent IPO in India for a firm called SKS, in which they were oversubscribed 13 times. They raised $155 million to grow the company, and they returned $195 million in capital and profits to the shareholders who had been invested for the last 4 or 5 years. The profits that attracted all that money came from somewhere. Probably they came from the interest that was paid by the borrowers, right? So my point is not that profit is bad, because it's not. It's important to fuel a growing business and to pay a return. But we live in a world in which there's sort of one best way. There's either real business or there's charity. There's for-profit or there's not-for-profit. Maybe you could participate in this, in believing that there is a hybrid space, and challenge those dichotomies or truisms or mantras. Many segments could evolve in this space in between charity and profit maximization. There might be 10 separate segments. And wouldn't it be interesting to say, let's not have any more silver bullets. Let's just sort of see what works and see how it evolves and use our brains and our ability to innovate to solve some of the problems that we have here in this country, overseas. So that's my proposed Declaration of Independence. for you. You choose the combination of financial and social return that you want to invest in. And don't let anybody tell you that it's 15 or nothing, or 15 or a grant. It's what you choose, and let's see what happens. Thank you.
Mary's clearly the younger of the two of us, so she gets to stand up there while I sit and ask these questions. Okay, Mary, we have questions in a bunch of different categories.
Okay.
Let me just, before I start, I did not mention that at the Commonwealth Club, it's our custom for people to write their questions on a question card and let me aggregate them or read them so that... One, so that they can all be through the microphone and we can record easier, and also so that I can ask similar questions together. So if you have questions, please go ahead and hand them to our volunteer who's picking them up. So there's several there's a number of questions about Shore Bank specifically and essentially micro-lending or community lending. So let's get into those ones first.
Okay.
First of all, has any U.S. Or Western microfinance lender achieved 10,000 customers? Do you know? And if so, what is it?
If the person were asking 10,000 cumulatively...
borrowers, I suppose.
Right, cumulative borrowers. I think that... Acción Texas probably would have a stable of 10,000 customers. They have operations all over Texas, and they're beginning to provide back-office services to microfinance organizations around the country. They've got a very, very sophisticated technology infrastructure and are really worth looking at.
We have a couple of representatives here from Opportunity Fund, which is the largest microlender in Northern California. And their issue is one that I've heard mentioned globally, which is we have the money, we just have a hard time accessing the borrowers and the small businesses that need our money. Hmm. What's your advice for that?
Let's see. What I really think? Is that what I'm supposed to answer, what I really think?
Absolutely, yes.
I suspect that very talented lenders always attract enough borrowers.
Okay.
So I don't mean to say anything negative about any of the 450 microfinance organizations in this country. But I think that that the customer knows when they're dealing with a generalist who is maybe not really going to be able to add value to their business and when they're not. And that too much – that when – I've seen it again and again in banks that great lenders just get inundated with demand. So it's sort of that idea.
But it's also – when Mohammed Yunus kicked off this program – You know that Grameen America has a number of storefronts at this point. And one question was, what kinds of businesses are you funding? And his answer was, in-home beauty salons, in-home nursery schools.
Right.
So I suppose one question is, how many of those do you continue to need? And, you know, is that a solution that's really scalable within a certain community? Or do you need to be essentially offer coaching and training for people to get into other kinds of small businesses?
Right. I think that in this country, it's much, much harder to make a lot of money with a very simple home-based business because everybody can go to a mass market provider that's cheaper, cooler, more fun. So I agree that in this country that people, that small entrepreneurs, in order to compete, need more access to knowledge than they do in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, if there is nothing, anybody who starts selling baskets has a market, and it's very dense. But there are 25 million self-employed people in this country doing something. And I don't know if you added up all the customers of all the microfinance organizations in this country, if you could, I doubt that you'd get to 20,000. So there's a market there.
Right. On Shore Bank, one person wants to know, what's the worst advice you ever got from a consultant? And if there's a couple, you can name them both, you know.
Well, I can't. I don't know.
Okay.
Can't answer.
Okay. A number of people are concerned about the country and the innovations or the remedies to solve some of the nation's problems. So there's questions about foreclosed, both commercial and residential properties.
Foreclosure?
Yeah, foreclosed. So the questions are essentially, are banks and the government doing enough to deal with foreclosed commercial and residential properties, or do you have advice or thoughts about what could be done that are not being done enough or at all?
Well, I believe personally that the one thing that would make the most difference is if banks started actively lending again, so that there would be financing for the people who want to buy foreclosed properties or properties at all. There's no money flowing in these markets, so nothing can move. And the longer it doesn't move, the lower the prices go on the houses that have been foreclosed. So that's active lending by the banking system would go a huge way to unsticking the problem.
But this is the issue for banks. They say we are lending. And
they are not.
Okay.
I don't think. I mean, I can tell you that in half of the city of Chicago, they are not. I guess that's all I know.
Okay. And I cut you off. Were you going to finish that on the commercial properties?
Well, there's now this interesting mess that we've been reading about this week about banks not properly filling out documentation. But I think it's probably more likely that banks have had to innovate and let people stay in homes and just not foreclose. And I think that's been, I don't know how many banks do that, but I think that's a good idea. Actually, foreclosing does nothing but bad in the current environment. Mm-hmm. So I would be sort of, I don't know what good it does to foreclose if there's no buyers and no financing for the buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know a lot about commercial foreclosure.
Can you explain what the evolution of Shore Bank was and how that happened?
So you have to, it was like a different world in the late 60s, right, in this country. So you have to, this is sort of like archaeological history, but there was a time that was different. There was no bank credit in African American neighborhoods at all. There was a panic selling in order to encourage people to sell their, white people to sell their homes and move out of neighborhoods. So the neighborhoods in, at least in the Northeast and the Midwest, neighborhoods were just consigned to go down once they changed racially. And it was just, it's what life was. So the genesis of Shore Bank was just saying that couldn't possibly be the case that if a neighborhood had African Americans living in it, it was no longer a decent neighborhood. I mean, it was just, let's prove that that's not the case. Let's prove you can have a nice neighborhood that African Americans live in and that African Americans will pay back loans as well as white people. That's the genesis.
And what about the current evolution? Are you happy at the way Shore Bank has become these separate companies, and do you feel that that's a real positive way for each of these entities to go forward?
No.
Can you flesh that out a little?
No, but I would like, I think that there's a good chance that these independent companies will all thrive and they will innovate in unexpected ways, and that maybe the old Shore Bank had lived its useful life. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's a possibility that it'll work out just fine. But in the process of it, a really wonderful organizational culture was lost, a place that had attracted phenomenal amounts of talent for many, many decades, and we're now dismantling that organizational culture, and it's very painful to do that.
So let's talk about your relationship with Lloyd Blankfein, which... I'm kidding. Let's talk about the relationship between smaller community banks and large, big, either commercial or investment banks. You mentioned briefly that there could be more of a... I don't believe you used the word synergy, but that they can complement each other's work. And certainly big banks did come... And participate in this reincarnation of Shore Bank. They felt it was in their interest to do so. So how will the relationship between the big banks and the community banks, how should it be, and what is the potential there for a really useful and viable partnership?
Well, there's a wonderful woman who was in charge of making the investment decision for Chase in the Shore Bank transaction. And she was completely clear that Chase, you know, had all these resources and had all of these talented capacities inside the company that they could put to the use of organizations like Shore Bank and would love to, and that was the opportunity. So I think, but in all the time that I worked in community development banking, people never really took advantage of of being able to do a business deal between either a community bank or a big bank or a not-for-profit or a big bank. I mean, if you really set your mind to it, you could have gotten a lot. There's a fellow right now whose name is Bob Anibali, who's at Citigroup. And he was a senior risk manager there and then got interested in microfinance. And he persuaded his superiors to let him set up a business unit in Citibank that would just do business deals with microfinance organizations around the world. And so he spent 2 or 3 years making money for Citibank and helping microfinance organizations. And just recently he's turned his attention to the U.S. So he's the kind of guy on the big bank side who would be fabulous to work with, because he's highly motivated to find this connection. Really 80% business, 20% social.
And what does that connection look like? Are those big banks making loans to the community banks or creating joint funds?
Well, let's see. So what Citigroup did as its first act was it made a, $200 million loan to a partnership between the Calvert Foundation and Opportunity Finance, for it to lend to not-for-profit CDFIs around the country. $200 million, just like that. He's going to make money at it at the interest rate that he's charging, and Calvert doubled its size with the access to this money. It's sort of like you have to be focused on what do I have that's of use, and where's our mutual interest?
But this notion of community banking, microfinance, is somewhat of a sexy topic. Is there more interest for big banks to look for these innovative alternative arrangements? Do you see that kind of... I mean, this is a successful partnership that you just described. Does it have traction? Is it going to be replicated?
I don't know. I think it would... The last time that the large banks, I think, got really excited about community reinvestment was when the Clinton administration put a lot of guts into the enforcement of the Community Reinvestment Act, And the large banks knew that they would be stopped from merger activity if they didn't have an excellent record at community reinvestment. And they all got religion at the same time, and they got really interested in community reinvestment. So that was a stick. And then in the Bush administration, that went away. In the Obama administration, there's been interest in this field, but no pressure on the large banks to focus. The fact that 18 large financial institutions became the investor in SureBank has got to be, way up there in terms of the amount of financial commitment to community banking, community development banking. Must be $130 million from the large banks into one bank on the south side of Chicago. And they really cared about preserving the institution. So there are people inside those institutions who understand that if our, you know, if the society deteriorates, that nobody wins.
Mm-hmm. So let's then switch a little bit to what the government's role is in providing a conducive regulatory environment. Are there, it sounds like you're advocating the reinvigoration of CRA or, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Anything else?
I think there's lots of areas, but they're not necessarily areas that I'm really an expert in. I have colleagues at the Center for Financial Services Innovation who are constantly recommending the ways in which government programs can create incentives for people to save.
There's a specific question about the Dodd-Frank bill and how that will be a positive.
Beats me.
Okay. one of the areas, finance has made a lot of, the financial services industry has made a lot of money getting into, and also gotten in a lot of trouble, as we know, getting into alternative investments like hedge funds and different kinds of derivatives trading, et cetera. Are there positive types of innovation within community banking along those lines that should be encouraged?
I don't think so. I think, the kind of financial engineering that happened in the large banks was something they could do because of their size and their technical expertise. Community banks tend to have small staffs, not huge profit margins.
Right.
They don't really have the resources to highly innovate, I think. I think what they could use the most is more deposits and more equity capital with which to carefully grow. And that's just, it's sort of Vince is sitting there in the back of the room and, he's growing New Resource Bank carefully over 5 or 6 years. Every year it grows another $20 million, and every year it grows probably another $20 million. But it will become a very substantial bank by just organically growing over time, and these banks deserve to be supported. And a deposit matters.
So. Let's talk about environmental lending, which I believe Vincent's Bank is an environmental lender. Why do you need a separate bank to do environmental lending, and what does that bring to the table? And I know you are very involved with SureBank's efforts in this regard.
So, Vince, I'll give my answer if you'll give your answer. Okay.
Yeah, the simple answer is because the other banks don't do it, meaning that their perspective is all financial. And if you want to integrate in that perspective, I'm not saying that some of the big banks don't have divisions now that are beginning to focus on that, but we ourselves are
okay, thank you.
So when capital controls and sort of whoever owns the bank gets to say what's the most important thing. And so if the owners of the bank say the most important thing is to build this market of environmental banking, then that's what happens. If the owners say we want 38% return and to get as big as possible, then you would not invest as much time and energy in understanding the environmental ramifications of a loan.
Okay, I want to just switch a little bit to this notion of social entrepreneurship, which is what this series overall is supposed to be about. In social entrepreneurship, there's a few key themes. You hit on one in your talk, which is essentially profit versus nonprofit and the kind of appeal of sustainability that a profit stream can bring about. And your challenge was a terrific one because it seems that the pendulum has swung a little bit to profit making is the answer, and a hybrid model mm-hmm. is something that can and should be explored. Another theme is the focus on the word entrepreneur, which often means an individual who is driven and passionate, and we're going to fund this person, and this person is out there. And SureBank is an interesting, I suppose, entity because you started off with four people from the beginning. So what do you think of this term social entrepreneurship, and can it be applied to a team?
Well, it better be able to be applied to a team because very few enterprises make it because of one person. Period. We had a run-in with the Skoll Foundation a couple years ago because we were looking for capital from them, and they said, "Well, you're not a social entrepreneur. You're this ancient institution." You know, we finance young social entrepreneurs. So we wrote a long paper arguing for funding institutional social entrepreneurs, but we still didn't get the money. So I think that there's a kind of a cult of the individual hero.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's, you know, really tried to make something happen knows that you're really trying to build an institution and it relies on many, many people.
So this, all these people that are doing microfinance who went to the SOCAP conference, if they were here, it would be a very crowded room. But what would be your words of wisdom to them? They're all, you know, starting new. Microfinance is a terrific answer. There's all this energy out there. What can you tell them?
So I want to ask factually, was there really a noticeable focus on microfinance?
Yes.
In globally or in this country?
One of the keynotes was focusing on Uganda.
Right. Right.
So we focused a lot on that. But there was quite a few different microfinance. And the Hoop Fund was one that they kind of got in there. And Vitana, which is doing education around the world.
Okay, so, and I'll say again what the question is.
That if there's actually quite a few questions here with people who want to get into this world
of microfinance.
Of microfinance. Yeah. And, you know, I think low-income lending mm-hmm. More broadly. And I suppose, you know, you mentioned some of your lessons, but on an individual level to someone,
yeah.
Do they need to go work for a bank first? Do they need an MBA? What are your lessons for people who are entering into this field?
So I think a person who wanted to have a career in international microfinance could probably be challenged for 30 or 40 years. It would be a great career. And in order to break into the field, they should probably make a loan to somebody someday, somewhere, and they should maybe have an MBA, and they should live abroad, and then they maybe will get a chance to get into the field. And over time, you know, it will grow into small business and housing finance and savings accumulation and mobile banking, and it'll be a great career. The people who worked at Shore Bank had a great career for 20 or 30 years. They never got bored. And there is not, this is neither, certainly U.S. development, economic development, is not a field of study in any college, any business school. And it's really a shame that it's not, because it is a serious professional career. International microfinance, I think, will get there, though it will become, you know, there's enough academic interest in it that the schools, the universities will figure out how to get those students. But it'll be good for the field.
Does it make sense to you that Grameen Bank now has come from Bangladesh to the United States?
Excuse me. No, I think it's kind of silly.
Okay, well, I won't tell Dr. Eunice you said that. And I doubt he's listening to KQED on a regular basis.
Right, that's better watch out for that.
Let's just talk a little bit about your personal experience, Mary. What have been some real highlights for you in your career? And also, if you don't mind, a real low point. There must have been times where you thought, what the heck am I doing? So could you just personalize the story a little bit and tell us about some highs and lows for you?
Okay, well, some highs were, I suppose, the period of time that I was a small business lender. It's a lot of fun to make loans to small businesses. Flipping forward 20 years, we created an equity fund, and I kind of drove that to make equity investments in small banks in Africa and Asia. And the first fund was a huge success. That was very exciting. Every time we opened an office in a new city, that was fun. And then all the talent that goes through an organization, sort of the it's a lot, it's very nice to build an organization where people are happy to come to work because they actually care about the purpose of the work and content for a very long period of time. And sort of having the freedom to live that kind of life is sort of generally, maybe that's the most important reason to support social enterprises, so that we create employment opportunities where people really care about the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And down low points, well, the lowest point was sometime this summer.
Well, that's pretty amazing that it took all those years before
right.
You got to the low point. Okay. I don't know if everyone is completely familiar with what happened this summer. Do you want to just give a nutshell account of?
I'm going to give the account that was in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
And they are an accurate newspaper. But in general, we're trying not to talk too much about what happened. But if it was in the Wall Street Journal, I can tell you. So, because for the first time in its history, the bank started having high loan losses in 2009, mainly in the loans that it made on real estate on the south side of Chicago. The regulators began to push the bank to raise more capital, clean up the problem loans, et cetera. So we began the work of raising capital. It went slowly in late 2009, and then in early 2010, a man named Gene Ludwig, who was the controller of the currency for the U.S. government in the Clinton administration, and now is involved with a very prestigious consulting practice, raised his hand and said, I'm going to help you guys raise this capital. And I think he put aside half of his job and for the next 3 or 4 months used all of his resources to help us to actually raise capital. And we had to raise $125 million of it. And we got to a week before the deadline, and we had $112 million of the $125 million. And he pushed and pushed. And on the day of the deadline, we had $147 million. So we had beat our $125 million target by $20 million, and it was all the largest financial institutions in the country. The deal was they had all said, we'll do this, we'll put our money in escrow, provided that the U.S. government, in its a special use of the TARP money, will commit $70 million. So we waited for that to happen, but it did not happen, mainly because there was some interagency regulatory body that had to agree with the FDIC. The FDIC was our primary regulator, and it refused to agree with the FDIC. And so after being disappointed by that, the investor group said, well, maybe if this isn't going to work, we can just directly acquire the bank from the FDIC. So that took another month. Almost all the investors stuck. And on August 20th, this investor group of large financial institutions acquired Shore Bank from the FDIC. And the next day, like it does, like it happens everywhere, the next day the bank opened up. So it was closed at 1 minute after 6 on a Friday night, and it opened up at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and there's been continuous service. So that's what happened. And the right wing had a field day with Shore Bank. It is an election year. And who knows what happened.
Okay. Well, I think on that note, I will go back to my script, which is up here, and go over here. Well, thank you very much. Our thanks to Mary Houghton, Community Bank Pioneer, and personal illustration of the power of combination of passion, innovation, and sweat equity. That's my own definition. Today's program has been the fifth in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.